From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The cable TV reality show My Husband's Not Gay premiered last night. For those unfamiliar with the hubbub surrounding the show, it features Mormon men here in Utah who all experience same-sex attraction and yet are living in straight marriages. Mitch Main is a gay Mormon, and he acknowledges the show is destined to be entertaining, but he says it's also dangerous. The therapeutic practices the couple go through in the show, he says, are questionable at best. And really, these men are in denial, he says, not just about their sexuality, but the risk factors associated with repressing it. Main says the show is no more an accurate depiction of a gay man than The Real Housewives of Orange County reflects the life of a stay-at-home mom. Today in the program, we're talking about the show and the questions surrounding it. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last night on the cable television network TLC, a new reality program premiered called My Husband's Not Gay. It's one program among dozens, of course, and to give you a sense of where this one may fit, consider some of the other shows on the network. My 600-pound Life, Sex Sent Me to the ER, and I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant. Over the years, the lineup of shows on that network has included Hoarding, Addiction, Body Deformities, Psychics, Wedding Dresses, and Cupcakes. The New York Times reporter Neil Genslinger described this latest show as a classic example of what he called the law of incendiary acceleration in reality television, which is you take one subject guaranteed to inflame some people, in this case religion, and you pair it with another, homosexuality, and you're guaranteed to get much more than twice the usual reaction. In the case of My Husband's Not Gay, this is a show centered here in Utah. It features four Mormon men who all say they experience same-sex attraction. They don't call it gay. And yet, they're either in straight marriages or they're looking for one. There's a moment from last night's program we're going to play right now. Tom has a date with a woman. And so they've all gone clothes shopping for him. And at this point, they encounter some gay men here at the shop.
I've had a few people be shocked to find out that I am attracted to men.
You're attracted to men, but you're going on a date with a girl?
Yeah, so we don't really call it gay. We call it SSA, same-sex attracted, right? I experience the feelings, but I've chosen to find a wife, get married, have kids.
Why?
I've just always wanted that, I think. Some of that comes from religion, for me, faith.
The program has produced that same kind of baffled reaction around the country, as well as some outrage and a petition drive to cancel the show. Critics say these relationships send harmful messages to gay men. Today in the program, we're talking about the program and some of the questions surrounding it. Joining us first on the program is David Matheson. He is a writer and a psychotherapist, a former clinical director of the Center for Gender Wholeness. That's an organization that offers therapy treatment to men who experience what they call unwanted same-sex attraction. And Dave Matheson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I guess we should begin with, there's that question of defining our terms. How do you define your own orientation? I mean, I think everyone would agree that orientation, sexual orientation, is fluid. So where do you see yourself on that continuum? Because gay is a word you don't like. Is that right?
I wouldn't say gay is a word I don't like. I would say that gay is a word I don't identify with. So what I should add here to your introduction to me is that I, in addition to working with men with unwanted homosexuality, I also have experienced that myself. That's part of my own life history, which is why you're asking the question.
Yeah, of course. Which we're going to get to, because I want to hear how your own personal experiences informed all of this.
Great.
Not gay, at least you don't identify with gay. So how, they're same-sex attracted, that's sort of the word. How do you define these particular men, you in particular as well? How do you define where you fit on that continuum?
That's a really good question. And I'm glad you're starting with that question, actually, because I think that this is one of the most crucial parts of the conversation, is how does an individual identify? And so what I've noticed among people that I've worked with and among people out there in the community that I've not worked with is that there's this vast array of identity, you know, of how we define ourselves. And part of what I think is important is that we allow that we allow there to be this large and also fluid sense of identity, and that we make it safe for people to identify where they, you know, feel, where they resonate. So to your question of how I identify as a man. In terms of sexuality, I would identify as heterosexual. I do still have...
Heterosexual with attraction to men?
Heterosexual with attractions to men that for me are not sexualized at this point in my life. They've been very sexual in the past. At this point in my life, there's attraction. I'll notice men that I think are beautiful or men that seem like they would offer great friendship or that I admire. And for me now, it's not sexual because of, you know, the particulars of my own life journey, the kinds of traits that I had inside myself that others may or may not have. I was able to make a pretty large shift in terms of how I experience other men. And I know as a
therapist, to shift away from the sexual
to part. Shift further from sexual and more toward a sense of identification with them, appreciation of them, admiration of them, and sometimes also still envy of them, which I think is so well within the normal range of what men experience with each other.
What do you mean envy? That you envy that they're living a life that maybe...
No.
What?
Envy. Like if I see a man with really admirable traits,
yeah.
I might look at him and go, you know, in a weaker moment of myself, say, wow, I wish I was more like that man. I wish I had his youth. I wish I had his intelligence. I wish I had his body. I wish I had his money. And again, that to me has nothing to do with sexuality. It's just, you know, part of being human and part of... you know, struggle with self-worth.
Yeah. There's a, let me read, so many comments are coming in and I wanted to read you a few because I think some reflect the way you yourself are thinking about all of this. Here's a comment from Mark who writes this. Freedom to choose is a constitutional principle that still needs protection from the tyrants of society who would dictate how you live your life. We should support and celebrate individuals making choices for themselves, even if we don't agree with the choices they come to. This is sort of where you are, right? That these are choices people have a right to make.
Absolutely. And I would extend that same right to a gay man or lesbian woman or a transgendered person or anyone else. We in a plural society.
To live their life.
To live their life with dignity and with honor. And so as I look at the men and the women in the show last night, although I don't completely like everything I saw in the show, as I look at them, I think this is a life choice that they're making. And my hope is that we as a society and we as a mental health organ group or in industry, that we can rally around those people as well to help them make informed decisions and help them live a fulfilling and, you know, happy life.
But here's the counter to that. And this comes from Micah, who sent this response, actually, I think, to Mark or to the general idea. Anyway, Micah writes, celebrating a person's right to choose is one thing. Glorifying a practice that leads to a bad quality of life is more than irresponsible, it's downright deplorable. So I think a lot of people can agree with you that this is a matter of individual choice, for sure, that a person has a right to choose the nature of their relationships. Mm-hmm. But now we're starting to come up with data that shows the outcomes of these kinds of relationships. Later on the program, we're going to talk to a psychologist, John DeLynn, who's done this study I'm sure you've heard of,
mm-hmm.
that it's a study of LGBT Mormons that included those married to opposite sex partners
mm-hmm.
that found, let me give you some bullet points, 69% of these relationships end in divorce. More than 70% of gay Mormons end up leaving the church. Gay Mormons who are celibate who are living in these mixed orientation marriages report a lower quality of life than people with debilitating chronic diseases. And here's one more. They have high rates of depression, high rates of lower self-esteem. So it's one thing to say they should be able to have a right to live how they want. But it's another thing to say, here are the consequences. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of different points that you just put out, and each one of them would need to be looked at individually. My response would be, yes, I've seen that. I mean, as a therapist, you know that I must have seen that sort of thing. I've seen the marriages that don't work. I've seen the low self-esteem. I've seen the suicidal ideations. All of that is very much a part of this ecosystem. Yeah. And again, my call to people, my call to action to society would be to rally around and support these people. I mean, the bottom line is that there are people who it will be a good life choice for them to perhaps move away from their old faith and to move into a lifestyle that fits well with their a gay identity. There are other people, myself for example, that just – that would never work. And so what we need is a better mental health system to help those people to deal with the difficulties that they're up against, because I admit it's very clear that those difficulties are there.
If someone comes to you and says, I'm LDS – my church has a certain perspective on same-sex marriage, mm-hmm. which is going to keep me mm-hmm. from living that way. But I have same-sex attraction. Where do you start with a person like that?
That's always the great question. Where do I start? I would start by trying to understand the full range of what's going on in that person because some people – I mean, that's what.
So are you looking for the person who are you going to be able to identify? This person is going to be suicidal if they continue on this path of trying to live a life as a heterosexual relationship. They need to get out now. Go live as an authentic gay person. Or are you looking for those who might be able to, as you have, made this conscious choice?
Well, I wouldn't be looking at it in that kind of bifurcation right from the start. It's never that simple. Right. And besides that, they come to me with all kinds of things already going on. They're in a marriage. They're dating a girl. They're in a relationship with another man. And so it's really about trying to understand where is this person coming from right now? And what's – key piece is what's driving this? You know, so if they come and they sit down and they say, I have to get rid of my homosexuality, that sends up alarm flags for me. I have to get rid of that.
Yeah.
And so then it's about understanding what's behind that, what's behind all of the anxiety about it, and then trying to work through that, or if there's a relationship going on, what's the essence of the relationship? What's going on with the wife? What about her pain? Does she need therapy? Do they need couples therapy? It's just really about assessing the individual, and it's so individualistic that it's very hard to describe a particular pathway.
Mr. Matheson, or is it Dr. Matheson?
No,
Mr. Matheson, mm-hmm. I wanted to get your reaction to the dearth of scientific evidence that this sort of therapy you're engaging in actually works. I'm sure you know the American Medical Association, the American Counseling Association, they all oppose it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you know the American Psychiatric Association says that the risks to this kind of therapy includes depression and anxiety and self-destructive behavior. Now, how do you respond to the idea that so-called reparative therapy does more harm, in fact, than good?
So you asked two questions. One is, how would I respond to the dearth of research, and how would I respond to those accusations? The men come to me with – and by the way, I've worked only with men, so as I speak, it's going to be all about men.
Sure.
The men come with all of that. What I've noticed in my own experience is
come with all what?
Come with the depression, with the anxiety, with the suicidal thoughts. That's there when they come, which is why they see
– But why do they feel that way? I mean, what a lot of psychologists would say is they feel that way because they can't – because no one is allowing them to reconcile the reality of their orientation with their life. And once
Absolutely.
They then are allowed to, someone says, look, don't try to get married to a straight woman. Go be gay. Go live your sexual fulfilled life, and you'll stop being, or within reason, feeling that sense of depression and low self-esteem.
Well, that's one way to go. But a lot of men that I've worked with in my own life experience is that I didn't have to do it that way. I was able to deal with, to experience, and to truly plumb the depths of my identity without choosing into a gay life. And so in a sense, I came out. And I very much worked through shame, worked through anxiety, worked through fear, but with a different outcome. And either outcome, in my view, as a therapist, is an acceptable outcome. But in terms of the research, if we can talk about that, it's virtually impossible to get any research on that might take a really clear look at what you call reparative therapy. I don't like that term personally. Okay. But whatever, sexual orientation change efforts, I'm not crazy about that term either. But getting that research published is virtually impossible, number one. And number two, it's very difficult to get money to do that kind of research. And those of us that do that kind of therapy rarely have the time or the resources, because no one will support that research because it's politically very incorrect.
I want to talk about some of the methods of therapy that you use. And there's one, I'm not sure if this is your idea or an idea that you use, but okay, there's one particular method reflected in last night's program, mm-hmm, the TLC program, My Husband's Not Gay. They're all at this park playing basketball. With Tom, a man who says he experiences same-sex attraction, but he wants to be in a heterosexual relationship. And they're basically watching men play basketball.
Right.
Let me play this clip because I want to talk about what's going on here and what you're hearing in this. This
Great.
Is a clip from the TLC reality program, My Husband's Not Gay.
I don't think I'm playing basketball to make me more manly. I'm playing basketball to feel connected to a part of masculinity I felt excluded or rejected by.
Any of them dangerous for you?
Maybe one. The tall one in gray.
Uh-huh. That's who I'd say. When I'm out with the guys, yeah, we'll look at other guys for sure. What's the danger score? The danger scale is a way to bring out some of the inner feelings and figure out, oh, okay, that is attractive to me, and I didn't even realize it.
The danger scale goes from 0 to 4. A 1 on the danger scale is you notice, you look.
A 2 means you looked again.
A 3, you'd be tempted to turn around and look again and again.
A 4 pretty much means you're requiring restraints.
2.5.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'd go higher than that.
That's some danger.
That's why the basketball's been fun.
Hey, your wives are here.
Hello.
How's it going?
You gotta admit, that's funny. That last bit at the end, but it seems so absurd, Dave Matheson. I mean, doesn't it? Now, are you familiar with this so-called danger scale?
The danger scale was new to me as I watched the program last night. I should tell you, I'm pretty close friends with Jeff Pret,
okay,
Tom, and Curtis.
These are the men in the program.
The men in the program, yeah. But the danger scale was new to me. As a therapist, I would not have used the danger scale. That kind of sent some red flags up for me. Now, I think I get why they're using that, because they've made a life choice. And in that life choice, going too far down a path of attraction toward men would be a dangerous thing for the choices they've made in their life, right?
Yeah.
But,
keep going. Sorry.
But therapeutically, if I was working with a man, I would not invite him to just rate it as a danger scale. Rather, I would invite him to sit with the feeling. And maybe this is what they're doing and maybe it's not. I don't know.
So is part of the therapy to have these men consciously expose themselves to attractive men?
Not necessarily consciously.
No, I mean, not consciously. It's not part of the therapy.
That happens all the time. They don't have to intentionally do that. So rather, I would take what they bring in the door. In other words, they come to me and they say, I saw a guy today, or I talked, whatever. And I would probably more likely have them sit there and just really feel what that was about, come to a deep understanding of it, because they're going to learn a ton about themselves. They're going to learn a ton about how they relate to men. They're going to learn a ton about their anxieties, about their shame, about their envy, about their sense of worth. And that, to me, is what's important in understanding, or in our experiences with other men, is understanding what does that mean about me, and then what life choices do I want to make based on that.
Is it true that as part of this therapy, there are these so-called holding nights where men get together, and I've even heard stories, and I want you to correct me if this is wrong, where men get together and hold men who are trying to deal with their same-sex attraction, mm-hmm, that they get together in these therapeutic sessions. In some cases, they're naked, and they hold each other to assess whether they're becoming essentially aroused. Is that something that you do?
No, definitely not.
You don't do that?
No. Well, see,
have you heard about this?
You've brought in a couple of different things. Part of it's true, part of it's inaccurate.
Okay, tell me the true and the inaccurate.
The holding naked, don't see a whole lot of that.
You ever done that?
I have done that.
You have done
that? I have done that in my distant past.
Did it work?
How do we define work?
Did it make you – I mean, yeah, that's a great question. I mean,
so now,
so wait. You were in a group of men who were naked. You held each other.
No.
And you talked about the fact that you were becoming aroused.
No. It wasn't like that. In my distant past, I've been in relationships where I held another man
I see.
Naked.
See, but my question is about the therapy.
But that's a whole
whether
different
or not
thing.
These are methods that are used in therapy.
No.
Hot tub nights where men get in hot tubs naked together and talk about the fact that there are I mean, these sound absurd, but these are techniques that are used, are they not?
They're not used. I wouldn't use them as a therapist. I know that that goes on out there in the community, that people do this, that they get together and do some of these things.
Do you support them?
There's aspects of it I support, and there's aspects I don't support. So one of the things that is helpful for men is to receive connection, to receive warmth and affection with other men. And so sometimes being held by another man is a very beneficial thing. Being held and really talking about your arousal or being held naked, I'm not sure that that's that therapeutic. I wouldn't recommend that. Certainly that'd be unethical and I would lose my license for doing such a thing. But in terms of healing wounds or gaining a sense of closeness or bond, a lot of it for some of these men and others not at all, but for some of these men, there's just a real touch deprivation. And so being close, being held by another man in a way that's going to be non-sexual can be tremendously healing and relieving to them. And for other men, it's a disaster.
Yeah. You're Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with the idea that your church has been evolving in its position toward same-sex attracted people, that it's more open and more accepting to gay members than it has been in the past?
Definitely.
So what's your impression of where the church then stands on these kinds of therapeutic practices? I think there's this sense that the church openly embraced them, and even some fairly deplorable ones. Electroshock therapy was done, I know, in the 70s and perhaps even into the 80s. So where do you see where is the official church, as you see it, as an active Latter-day Saint, on these kinds of therapeutic practices?
The church is nowhere on those therapeutic practices. I mean, the church won't say anything about therapeutic practices. The only thing I'm aware of is that they have distanced themselves from what they call reparative therapy, whereas they used to mention it on the LDS Family Services a website. It's been taken off. My understanding is that the church is trying to keep a distance from it because, I mean, it's not really their position to know what works and what doesn't work.
So that doesn't give you pause, that the church is not openly embracing these kinds of practices like they used to, and yet you're engaged in them.
I don't know that they ever used to really embrace them. I mean, there was more – I mean, they used to be more positive toward organizations like Evergreen.
But you don't deny that leaders within Mormonism were, in fact, encouraging people to try programs like Evergreen, try other programs that were so-called reparative therapy programs.
Yeah, yeah. That they did, and now they really don't.
Okay.
What to make of that is anyone's guess. But it doesn't give me pause. No, not at all.
Why?
Because, I don't really expect them to know. It's not really their job to know that.
Okay. For you, David, you said that this is not just a religious factor for you. That, in fact, you've said this. You've said that what you see in a gay life, your perceptions of it, is just not for you. What do you mean by that? What are you seeing in a gay life that's just not for you?
The lack of a wife.
Comes down to that.
It comes down to that. I mean, because I have friends who are gay who have children that they've either fostered or children that they have with their wife and now they're with a man. And so I understand that there's that. And of course, I didn't understand that 25 years ago when I made the choice to start this journey. But for me, it really comes down to there is something about the complementarity between me as a man and her as a woman that I want in my life and that I highly value. I also highly value the nuclear family.
Yeah.
You know, living with my wife and my children in the same house without other people involved, that to me is very beautiful.
Is the wife the important part or is it just the spouse?
It's the oppositeness.
Hmm.
The oppositeness
really?
Of a woman. Yeah. Hmm. The oppositeness of a woman. And that took
because,
me...
But that's an irreligious notion, is it not or no?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
Oh, completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Completely.
Let me ask you, we're out of time. I want to ask you, what about the woman? What about your wife? What are they getting out of this relationship?
I have great concerns about their well-being because I know wives who are flourishing in these relationships. I think my wife now is. I know that my wife for many years was not, and I put her through lots of pain. It has been a tremendous growth for her, but that's not an excuse. But I know many wives who have suffered greatly because of their husband's choices. And that's not unique to men with unwanted same-sex attraction being married. That happens all across all across our culture in the way that men don't take care of their wives well.
Let me ask you this finally.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain the way God made you? How do you explain the way God made you? Why would God make you attracted to other men? How do you explain that?
Uh-huh. So I can only explain that in a completely personal sense. In other words, I would not want you to generalize this to all other men. But my own explanation, the answer that's clear to me, is that God created me in the situation where I grew up, which was going to give me all kinds of life challenges, including same-sex attraction.
That's a challenge.
That's the way
you see it. No, okay, that's
me,
fine.
Absolutely.
But you hear about people in the gay community, the gay Mormon community, hate that connection, the idea that homosexuality is somehow this affliction, and it's often or always compared to, I see, alcoholism. It's the same as having an affliction to alcohol, but that's how you see it.
I don't see it as an affliction like alcoholism, but for me—
But you see it as an affliction you have to overcome.
Uh-huh, for myself. Overcome, how do you define that? But certainly not to pursue that life. And so I believe that this life experience, whether you call it challenge or not, this life experience, which is full of challenges, is a way to bring me back to him. It's a way to cause me to seek him on a very personal, very intimate level, because without that, I don't think that I would have made it. I don't think I would have made the choices that I made. And for someone else, it's a very different story, and they're responsible for their story, and I'm not.
It's David Matheson. He's a writer, a psychotherapist, former clinical director at the Center for Gender Wholeness in Salt Lake City. Joined us here in the studio. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Very much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're getting reaction to a reality show that features Utah couples, Mormon couples, in what is being referred to as mixed orientation marriages, which is to say these are gay men. They don't like that term. They're attracted to other men, but for various reasons, they want to be in heterosexual relationships. The program is called My Husband's Not Gay. It premiered last night on the cable television channel TLC, and as I said, we're talking about it today. Joining us now on the program is Mitch Main. He is an openly gay and active member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. For a time, he served in the bishopric of his ward in San Francisco as an openly gay man, we should mention. He's joining us from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. Mitch Main, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We also have Alan Miller with us. He was in a heterosexual marriage as a gay man for more than 20 years. Was a long time active member of the LDS Church, and he is joining us here in the studio. And Alan Miller, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with
Appreciate
us.
Appreciate it.
Mitch Main, I want to start with you. What were you hearing there with Dave Matheson? give me a sort of general reaction before we get into some particulars.
Well, I think you kind of hit it on the head with a couple of your comments, quite honestly, Doug, and it seemed very absurd and unrealistic. He did, however, say a couple of things that I was really interested in. He talked about how, you know, he views his role in the therapeutic role as helping this sense of shame, envy, and low self-worth that so many quote-unquote same-sex attracted Mormons feel. I agree, we should absolutely help that, but we shouldn't help it by the methodology that Mr. Matheson outlined. We should be looking at our Mormon culture and how we respond to these LGBT individuals, and a culture that actually fosters an environment where somebody who is LGBT grows up with the notion that in order to be accepted by their faith and their family and their community, that they should live someone else's version of their lives. He also mentioned that for him personally, this affliction was a way to seek out his Savior on a very personal level. And I tend to agree with a lot of that statement. I do not view my orientation as an affliction. It is a core component of who I am. If I were to take a pill today that would make me straight, it would change the kind of son I am, the kind of brother, uncle, cousin that I am. It would certainly change my talents and my skills. I would be a completely different person. But I view my orientation as one of the ways that I have had to also seek out my savior on a very personal level to understand not only how I fit within the LDS church, but how I fit within my savior's kingdom. So it has worked for me in a similar way, although I don't carry the baggage of shame because I believe I am made this way for a reason. And I am perfectly fine, not only in the eyes of myself, but also in the eyes of my Lord.
Your story is, I think, fairly unique. You were called to be in a Mormon bishopric, as I mentioned. It's a Mormon leadership position for the uninitiated. As an openly gay man, this is your authentic self, as you've described it, which I think must be a fairly high-profile event. And you've written about how it kind of opened the floodgates. Lots of men reached out to you to share their stories. Can you give us a sense of just generally what were you hearing from people when they heard that you had accepted this position in a Mormon bishopric in San Francisco?
Well, there was no shortage of commentary. That's for sure. And there still is not. By and large, what really surprised me, and Bishop Fletcher, who was the bishop I was serving with, you know, saw much of this online. And he came up to me a couple of Sundays after this whole thing rolled out and said, I cannot believe how the volume of people that are, you know, so supportive of this. You know, heterosexual, straight, married couples from suburban Utah were emailing me that I didn't even know, saying, I'm so glad that you're doing this. I'm so glad that our church is doing this. This is an answer to a prayer for me. So what this actually means, I think, Doug, is what we overlook is for so many people inside the Mormon faith, whether they're, you know, straight, gay, or anywhere in between, our position culturally on how we have rejected LGBT members from our families and from our wards and congregations has caused pain not only in the lives of the LGBT people, but in the lives of almost every Mormon. I mean, if you think about it, there's, what, 14 million Mormons worldwide. Science is going to tell us that, you know, 7 to 10% of that is LGBT, right? So, and add to that number then the moms and dads and the brothers and sisters and the aunts and uncles, and then add to that the close family friends and the bishops and the Relief Society leaders. And it becomes really clear that how we respond to LGBT Mormons and how we love them and how we keep them safe and close to us is an important issue, not just to gay Mormons, but to virtually every Mormon out there.
But Mitch, surely you must see your story as somewhat of an anomaly. You are, of course, centered in San Francisco. You did have an extraordinarily open-minded bishop. What do you do if you're gay? You want access to the so-called blessings of the Mormon gospel. You know, you want an eternal family. You want children. That is not available to gay men, to gay women, anyone at this point in the Mormon sort of official Mormon church. So what are you supposed to do?
Well, the interesting thing is the reason that I was called, Doug, and we did something differently here in San Francisco in terms of how we applied the doctrine. The philosophy here in San Francisco and in Oakland and in Berkeley and now in Seattle as well as Beaverton, Oregon, is we're throwing the doors open to everyone. So any LGBT Mormon, whether you're single and living under the confines of the policy as we understand it today, whether you're married to a partner of the same gender, whether you're dating somebody new every night, you are welcome in our congregation. We want you here. We want you to take part in the events. And to the extent that doctrine allows us to include these people in, you know, in temple recommendations, we shall do so. But our first step is, you know, we can't change doctrine, but we certainly can change culture.
But
our first step
how,
is to open the doors to these people.
But you do see how the fact that you can't change doctrine may drive people like Dave Matheson into deeply wanting a family. And since they can't have it in one way, they'll try it in another. I mean, do you have empathy in that for Dave in that sense and others like him?
I have empathy for the tragedy that Mr. Matheson views himself as unwhole as he is, and the value that a set of rules has for him is greater than the value that the life our Savior has given him has. Yes, I view that with some empathy, and you know, to that, I really have no response. I just think it's a tragedy. What really happens when, I mean, we'll hear from Alan Miller in a moment, who will tell firsthand you know, some of his own story. But what generally happens in those instances isn't a happy ending for either the LGBT member or the spouse. It, you know, let's just take a look back at the show last night. You know, as I watched it, of course, I was engaging in a lot of, you know, text and social media conversations with parents of LGBT Mormons and those in mixed orientation marriages. And what was resoundingly clear in the commentary that I was hearing is, look at the pain on these women's faces. And these men, they make the claim that they are happy, yet the fact that they are constantly lusting after men belies something very different. So I don't see that as something that is healthy or whole. And I do, in fact, hold a culture accountable where it does teach people like Mr. Matheson that in order to be healthy, happy, and whole, you have to live another version of your life.
Alan Miller, you knew you were gay when you were 5 years old. You knew fairly early on.
I knew I was different.
Yeah. It couldn't define it as gay, of course.
I had no idea how to define it until I was a teenager. But it was something that set me apart early on and impacted all of my interactions as I grew up. It was a challenge for me. It was a difficult situation for me. When I was 12 years old at the end of a scout camp, my best friend came up to me in love and put his arm around me and he said, "Alan, I know you like guys. That's okay. I love you anyway." And that frightened me because I'd never expressed that till then. Not too long after that, our family joined the LDS Church, and one of the great blessings of joining the church was the emphasis on family and the emphasis on the fact that we could become perfect. So as a 15-year-old boy, I saw...
You wanted that.
That's exactly right. I saw the church as a way of overcoming this desire that I didn't understand and couldn't manage.
How old were you when you got married?
21. I got home from my mission.
So you did the usual thing.
I was committed. My bishop told me if I kept the commandments, if I got married, if I kept the commandments, went on a mission, got married, had children, the Lord would make this unnatural desire disappear.
Do you use those words, unnatural desires?
Those are the words that he used. Yeah. And
he said, get married and you can cure yourself or at least overcome it.
I would be cured. They would disappear. I would be a heterosexual man. Oh. And I believed that, being a young man of faith. And so I married an amazing young woman.
Did she know?
Not when we were married.
Yeah.
I didn't tell her because I assumed that early in the marriage I'd be
healed.
There was no reason to tell her that. 5 years into our marriage, I realized, however, that those feelings, that desire was not going to change.
Now, here's what's interesting about your relationship, and I don't think it's atypical, but you told her,
mm-hmm.
and you guys chose to stick it out.
We did.
For a time.
We did. We chose to stick it out for our children. And one of the reasons we were able to do that is that she and I were the best of friends. First of all, she herself is an amazing woman. We're still good friends. She's always been very supportive of me and very understanding of the situation that we shared.
Yeah.
As she said, when it finally came time for me to come out 4 or 5 years ago.
This is when you had raised all the kids.
Yes. Mm-hmm. At that point, she said, you know, this is my coming out as well as yours, because people are not going to understand why I chose to stay with you through all these years.
So do you feel conflicted at all about that reality program? On one hand, these men are going through what you went through. They're making the same call that you made.
The fact of the matter is I see that reality program as a terrible tragedy because it gives young men the mistaken idea that they can have it all. The cost that my wife and I had to endure in order to maintain that relationship shouldn't have to be borne by any couple. And I especially look at my wife. She, as I said, she's an amazing woman. She deserved a complete relationship. She deserved to be married to a man with whom she could enjoy the depths of intimacy that are inherent in marriage. And I see her as making a tremendous sacrifice that really, on my part, had we been had our marriage started today, would have really painted me as a very selfish and inconsiderate individual.
Mitch Main, I want to ask you where the official church seems to be these days. Alan, I want to get you on this as well. Seems like the Mormon culture or the Mormon community is a factor here, because you've put it this way in a piece you wrote for the Huffington Post, that gay men who are living lives like the ones portrayed in this reality show are, as you put it, devastated by the wreckage caused when our Mormon community encourages gay individuals to live someone else's version of their lives. So the church culture is a factor here. What factor do you see that is in this story?
Well, I talked a little bit about that before, where, you know, in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, Seattle, where, you know, we're doing what we can in terms of throwing the doors open to everyone. The culture really, when
but
I served
but wait,
in the,
but wait, Mitch, so you're sure. Saying Seattle, you're saying, or, you know, you're saying Oregon, you're saying Northern California. These are all bastions of a certain way of thinking in some ways. How would that apply to Davis County, Utah, or Utah County, Utah? I mean, it's one thing to say where you are that may happen, but put it in the perspective of the broader culture, even those more conservative ones that I mentioned.
Well, I mean, it's quite frankly, then let's. I see the torment and the torture of families who live in Southern California who have gay kids who are routinely just tortured by their fellow Mormons, being accused of, you know, being advocates for, you know, the homosexual lifestyle by simply standing up and supporting their gay kid and saying, we're not going to kick him out and we're going to allow him to live an authentic life. We do torment these people, and our Mormon culture is very rigid. It's very important, though, to understand the doctrine behind what it means to excommunicate a gay person versus the culture. So in our doctrine, there's a very short list of things that we are required to hold a disciplinary council on, right? And those include things like child molestation, rape, murder, things that we can all agree are something that we should look at. On the next page is a list, a very long list of things that we may choose to hold a disciplinary trial on. And that includes lack of adherence to the law of chastity, whether it be homosexuality or heterosexuality. Hmm. What's traditionally happened over time, Doug, is as Mormons, we feel awkward around people who aren't exactly like us as a general rule. We have shifted that might list over to the must list. And so routinely when someone comes out, when someone is married and begins to be honest about their sexual orientation, when someone comes to us who already has a partner of their same gender, we immediately, our knee-jerk reaction culturally is to just excommunicate them because we don't know how to deal. That is a huge cultural flaw inside Mormonism. Our goal as Mormons is to love other people and be exemplary dignitaries of our Savior's unconditional love. And we are failing our LGBT brothers and sisters in that regard.
Well, we're running out of time. So let me ask you, it seems like, you know, we had this conversation with Nyland McBain, a Mormon feminist, who is saying there are certain constraints within Mormonism, but we can find some, she didn't, you like the word loophole. I seemed to see some flexibility within Mormonism. It sounds like that's where you are, is that, yes, there are some set rules here, but there's also room for a little bit of flexibility to play with the rules a bit. Is that where, how you're saying it?
There's flexibility in terms of how we apply the doctrine. Certainly in terms, we can be better in how we apply the gospel of our Savior and his inclusiveness. The other thing too that's important to know, Doug, is, you know, we've sort of forgotten that Mormonism is a faith of great optimism. You know, inside our teaching resides this principle of eternal progression, the idea that in this life, you know, it's a time to broaden and deepen our understanding, to treasure up truth wherever we find it, and to live fully. you know, this was actually reiterated by President Dieter Uchtdorf in a recent general conference. And his exact words were, you know, as good as our experience may be, if we stop asking questions and stop thinking, we can thwart the revelations of the spirit. And now here we have science presenting us with some really rigorous research that tells us that it isn't same-sex attracted. It's actually four distinct things. LGBT, they can't choose it. They are this way. It's a normative part of development. And to my Mormon fellows, I want to ask, do we now hear a knock at our own gate?
Alan Miller, I want to give you a final thought. You feeling happy these days?
Yes.
I don't mean that as a facetious question
at
all.
No, what I found is that individuals who have an opportunity to live an authentic life live a happy life. And I think that's the important message from all of this, is that these individuals who have to live under the radar, who have to live in relationships in which they aren't authentic, it's very difficult to find that inner peace that the gospel is supposed to bring to an individual.
That's Alan Miller. Thank you very much for being with us. Sure. Mitch Main, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Doug.
We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been getting reaction to a reality show that features Utah couples. These are Mormon couples in what's being referred to as mixed orientation marriages. It's raised a lot of questions that we're getting at. One of the questions comes up as to what are the consequences of these kinds of relationships. That brings us to John DeLynn. John DeLynn is founder of the Mormon Stories podcast. He's also a PhD candidate in psychology at Utah State University. His research focuses on the experiences of LGBTQ Mormons and former Mormons. And he's joining us from the studios of Utah Public Radio there in Logan. And John DeLynn, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug.
So we're running out of time. Forgive me for not giving you enough time, but I did want to spend some time on this study that you found. So give us a sense of what you did. You wanted, I guess, go beyond the sort of anecdotal impressions about the effects of these kinds of relationships and get some actual figures, some numbers.
Yeah. So Dr. Bill Bradshaw of BYU, Dr. Renee Gallagher, and another colleague, Katie Krall, together we surveyed over 1,600 Mormons and former Mormons who experienced same-sex attraction. We advertised in over 100 newspapers. We made additional outreach to believing and active Mormon groups like North Star and Evergreen. And, yeah, we wanted to see what the data show. And it's not a perfect sample, but we think it's the best data out there. And they show many of the things you've already discussed. Somewhere around 70-plus percent of LGBT Mormons that we surveyed end up leaving the church, which makes religion maybe not a very safe foundation to base your marriage. We found between 70 and 80% divorce rates, depending on the study. Our study was 69% as an estimate, but it probably will go higher. We found quality of life ratings, as you said, lower than for those who experience a disease called lupus, which is a very debilitating disease.
Explain that again. People who had lupus defined themselves as having a better quality of life than those who found themselves in these unhappy marriages.
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And these were largely active members of the church who were reporting these abysmally low quality of life ratings. I'm so happy you mentioned the wives, who in some cases are just suffering tremendously in these marriages. One of the really important findings from our study that maybe yours didn't mention, we asked the average Kinsey attraction rating for those who were successfully in a mixed orientation versus not. And we found that those who were in a successful mixed orientation marriage who hadn't yet been divorced had bisexual self-ratings for attraction, whereas those who were more exclusively same-sex attracted had divorce rates as high as 85%. And so, you know, what's probably most dangerous about this show and organizations like North Star is that they sort of hold out as celebrities these figures who are able to make it work. And it may very well be these people are bisexual, and it may very well be that right now it's working, but in the future it's not going to work. But if we put these people on the cover of LDS Living magazine and on the Ensign, and if we sell their books at Deseret Book, what that does is it sends the message to all these exclusively same-sex attracted Mormons that they can sort of run, you know, sort of win the lottery and have that successful marriage. But what they're unwilling to do is provide the other data maybe our data, that helps them make a more informed decision. So self-determination and respect, absolutely. But let's give these people the information they need so that they can make a more informed decision.
It seems like the church is, the Mormon church, of course, is pretty conflicted about all of this. What do you see as the reaction from the official church, if you're seeing any kind of indication as to how the church is dealing with this or thinking about all of this these days?
Yeah, I mean, a couple decades ago, it was really terrible. We have seen some modest positive gains. The church is no longer insisting that there isn't a biological component, so they're kind of backing away from claiming that it's a choice. They're now saying that it's not a sin to have the attractions. It's just a sin to act on them. They are backing away from reparative therapy, but still privately through LDS social services, they're very much tons of LDS family services professionals out there who are still engaging in reparative therapy or sexual orientation change efforts. But that, you know, at least, and they're calling on members to show higher levels of compassion, which I see as very positive. But those really are baby steps when you consider the fact that Utah leads the nation, as I understand, in suicides of young men between the ages of 15 and 24. And we know that a large percentage of that group are young gay and lesbian people taking their lives because they don't want to have to choose between their religion and their sexuality.
John, you've pointed this out, that if you're Mormon and you're gay, essentially you have two options. Now, Mitch Main might not agree with that, but the options you've pointed out is you decide to either live a celibate existence or get married to an opposite sex person. Is that still how you see it? Is these are the options if you're gay in Mormonism?
Yeah, there's really no other option if you want to retain your membership and be in full status. And that's why we're seeing 70%+ of LGBT members leave the church, because who wants to live a life? I mean, there are young gay men who try and have sex with their female spouses, and what they find is that it's a repulsive act to them, and they actually silently weep in the bed after they're done with the sexual act with their spouse. You know, it may be that Ty Mansfield can make that work, but we have record of hundreds and maybe thousands for whom that was a catastrophic decision. And so the church needs to open up a third possibility, which is that you get legally same-sex married and you're committed faithfully to your same-sex spouse, but you engage in the religion in all sorts of other ways. And in fact, what our study showed is that gay men and women who engaged in heterosexual marriages had quality of life ratings higher than the national average, straight or gay. And that's a really important message, is you can either choose a life comparable to having lupus or actually have a better than average quality of life if you're in a same-sex committed relationship.
That's John DeLynn, founder of the Mormon Stories podcast. John DeLynn joined us from Utah Public Radio in Logan. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.